and show and tell. There's a common myth about this book. In the beginning, the Bible, unauthorized, the English translation of the Bible, contains errors ranging from mistaken times of conception to gross libel. A correct understanding reveals that the real Bible has yet to be understood by the world. So this book is... Oh, we're doing a... So he actually bases this up. Now, there was a myth going around, which I also used to believe, which is that this book was written by the Lubavitch Rebbe's wife. Because there is a... She was a librarian in the public library, actually. That was her job. And the pseudonym used here is H. Moose. And her name was Chaya Musya. So many people think that actually she wrote this book, but in fact, it's not written by her, it's written by some rabbi who had another similar name, and it was not the...
Why didn't he use his name?
What?
Why didn't he use his name? Is it controversial?
I guess it's a controversial book, yeah. So, the people who published it, 37 books in Malibu, California. What?
That's how many books they published.
No, I don't know why they call that, but they're like a controversial publisher also. They publish all sorts of, mystical stuff. So I know it published originally, it's from the 40s. But there's an interesting thing. I probably follow the Malbim primarily, but for example, on here when he talks about the sins, so he says, I don't know where he gets the translations. I think he makes them up. But when he says this,
Jewish though, at least, right?
What?
They're at least Jewish, right?
Yeah.
His ideas.
Yes, that much yet. So for example, Elohim, he always translates as the godly spirit of law and order. So which is a better translation than just God. That's that. It's kind of cumbersome. So he has here, for example, here it says, and the serpent is translation of verse 1, on page 14.
Thank you.
I verse on page 14. You can look in the English on page 15. So his translation is, and the serpent was more subtle, that's how it translates arum, subtle, than any animal of the field, which the godly spirit of mercy, just because it says Hashem here, right? God's spirit of mercy, law, and order had made. And he said unto the woman, even if the godly spirit of law and order said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden, he goes on to say in the second verse, he puts in parentheses, and it is a good command indeed, right? It's not his own. It was a great command he gave you not to eat from the tree. And then the woman said unto the serpent, of the fruit of the trees of the garden we eat. Well, we may eat, but we eat. But of the fruit of the tree, which is the most attractive, standing in the parentheses, standing in the very midst of the garden, the godly spirit of law and order said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. And the serpent said unto the woman, ye shall not die either way. And the woman did conceive the tree as good for food. Good for food, interesting. And as delectable to the eyes.
Did you skip something?
No, that's what you have.
God knows that on that day your eyes will be
open. Oh,
that's right.
Right, sorry. So the godly spirit of law and order knows that in the days of you eat thereof, your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as God, knowing what is good and what is bad for you. Which actually does work out with the novice. And then the next verse, and the woman did conceive the tree as good for food and as delectable to the eyes, so hearing that it is also desire to make one wise, she took the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. And the eyes of both, and both were opened indeed, but they knew that they were betrayed and spiritually disrobed. And they sewed together leaves of crooked-rooted fig, crooked-rooted fig tree, and made for themselves scant coverings. So it says that, all these things he had there. And there, this is the real way to translate the Chumash, she says. And they heard the alarm of the godly spirit of mercy, law, and order, sounding angrily in the garden.
The alarm, okay.
In the spirit of the sinful day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the anger of the godly spirit of mercy, law, and order among the trees of the garden. And the godly spirit of mercy, law, and order called unto the man. And he said unto them, Where art thou? And he said, Thy alarm I have heard in the garden, but I am afraid. I am disrobed. I hide myself. And he said, Who told thee that thou art disrobed? Hast thou eaten of the tree? Well, have I warned thee that thou wouldest better not eat of it? And man said, The woman whom you gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I eat. And the godly spirit of mercy, law, and order said unto the woman, What is this thou hast done? And the woman said, The serpent inveigled me.
Well, good word.
What's
inveigled? Inveigled,
yeah.
Is
somebody
got bagels from?
No,
I-N-V-E-I-G-L-D.
It's like
a...
What?
Does that mean
inveigled? No, it's like, inveigled is like a... It's in a conniving way, right? Well, similar, but not quite the same thing. In other words, he twisted the truth in order to get me to do it. And I eat. Notice I put everything in present tense. And I eat. And the God of spirit and mercy, law and order, said unto the serpent, If thou hast done this, thou art indeed cursed to be more base than all the cattle kind and all the animals of the field. Thou creepest upon thy belly. Note, everything is in present tense. And thou eatest dust all the days of thy life. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seeding and her seeding. It will snap at thy leadership, and thou wilt snap at it with oppression. And unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply the sorrow of thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt give birth to children. Thy passion shall be for thy husband, and he will rule over thee. And unto the man he said, Since thou hast hearkened unto the vociferations of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree, concerning which I warned thee, saying, It were better that thou not eat not of it. The soil is cursed for thy fault. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. And thorns and thistles shall cause to grow for thee, and thou shalt eat the grass of the field. With the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the earth from which thou wast taken away. In parentheses, elevated to live in a delightful garden. Since a creature of dust thou hast remained, even unto a creature of dust shalt thou return again. Okay? So it goes on to the other sentence.
Where did he say that it's supposed to be present tense?
Good question. I don't know. I didn't read the commentary, so I don't know. But obviously he's doing that for a reason. So he claims that this is the real translation and that everybody's been misled all these years using the King James Version, the Authorized Version, he quotes, and of course using the Arts Coach came after him. But I'm not sure I would agree that his translations are precise, but it's interesting to have this idea that there are all sorts of things which it says here are to be taken as in the present tense, in other words, not as suggestions and all that kind of stuff, which he does, and maybe he has good interpretations of it or explanations of it. But in the meantime, we'll go back to the Malbim, where we were yesterday, and the Malbim we got up to was in verse Vav, right? We got up to verse Vav, the sixth verse, the bottom of page 14, I believe. The woman saw that the tree was good to eat, right? She saw that by eating the tree, she will be able to, I'm not sure how he said it. She saw that by eating the tree, she will be doing that which is necessary, because that was permitted to her. As it said, when it said, the way the mom is interpreting the verse, it says, Kitova ate the ma'akol, the tree was good to eat, she's not talking specifically about this tree. And all trees are good to eat, right? All trees are good. But this one is tadlo dinayim, it's desirous to the eye, that there's a difference between something which is, we mentioned this yesterday, something which is precious and something which is desired, something which is cute, like we said yesterday, or admirable. Somebody who finds something the somebody finds something cute, that's how it's perceived in his eyes, and it's only specifically so about something which he sees. In other words, if I see something, I think it's cute, it's nice, it's admirable. If I don't see it, I have no way of knowing, right, that it's something which is nice, admirable, or cute. But somebody who desires also something which is not in front of him. Even something which he doesn't actually see. And the example is that a person desires to gather silver and gold and money and all sorts of precious stones and to build great buildings and all of that kind of stuff which a person desires, it's not something which is in front of him. You can't see it, right? It's something which you believe is good for you, or rather you believe that you want, but you don't actually see it in front of you. As opposed to something which I see in front of you, which I can identify as something which is good or nice or admirable. So, for example, you know, I could say I want to have a new tape recorder, right? But I don't have a tape recorder in front of me. If I say, oh, this is a cute tape recorder, so I'm talking about this tape recorder which is in front of me, and say, oh, it's a cute one, right? Which it is, actually. So obviously the difference between things which I see and identify with an adjective and say, oh, this is a nice thing, and things which I desire, which are not necessarily in front of me. That's what the Malbim says. And he says, as a result, the tree was in and of itself something which was cute, so to speak. It was, how does he translate Nechmos? He says desirable. We said yesterday it's not a good translation. He says there's something which is admirable or cute because it gives a person wisdom. Right? What is he gives him? Seichel. What seichel? Sense, right? And as we said yesterday, when seichel precedes desire, when intelligence precedes desire, then that's good. Her focus have been first on the fact that it was admirable because it was provided wisdom, and then afterwards she would have desired it. So in fact, she might have been able to stop herself and say, you know what, I better not eat it. Because even though it looks admirable because of wisdom, it grants wisdom, but in fact, by eating it, I'm transgressing the will of God. So I should stop. But what she saw first is that it was desirable, right? Was that she wanted it, right? And so she saw that she wanted it, so therefore that clouded her judgment. And the fact that she said afterwards, and also makes people wise, is like an afterthought in a rationalization. So let me said more than that, though. He said that, again, when intellect comes before desire, it's good. Because the greater, the more intellectual a person is, the more he will realize that he should only desire that which is truly good and stay away from that which is potentially bad. But when desire precedes intellect, then the desire calls the intellect to assist it. And as a result, the intellect is joined after the desire and helps out the desire. In other words, your desire can't necessarily plan how to accomplish the aim of its desire, right? So let's say, you know, you have a tremendous desire for some beautiful woman, right? So that remains a desire. But if you put your mind to it, maybe you'll actually be able to find some way to meet this woman and so on and so forth. So therefore, the mind then becomes a servant of the desire, whereas desire is supposed to be a servant of the mind. In fact, the Sol Solanta says, I've mentioned it several times, I think I also mentioned recently, which is that the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination, is really the intellect. And the Yetzer Hara, the negative inclination, is really the emotions, or the desires. So if a person's Yetzer HaTov, his intellect, controls his emotions and desires, that's good. Because then he's using both things the way he's supposed to. His emotions are being channeled in the right direction. But if a person lets his emotions and desires control him and uses his intellect just in order to accomplish his emotions and desires, so then that's bad. And you know, with all due respect to the United States of America, the capitalistic system is based on the assumption, what?
You're right. Emotions
override. Right. I mean, not that I'm a communist. Well, of course, Trump. Communism is not good either. But the assumption of capitalism, having in my sinful youth listened to Rush Limbaugh for quite a bit, clearly the idea of capitalism is that everything is driven by the quest for money. and altruism is good. Altruism is only accomplished if you give people financial incentives to do, to be altruistic. That's, I think, the basis of republicanism to a certain extent. But the idea is, obviously, in that sense, yes, because you desire certain things, you, as a result, you'll do certain altruistic things as well. But it's not that the altruism is the basis of your seeking out to do things. On the contrary, the altruism is the tool which you have in order to be able to further your goal of what you desire. For example, and again, in capitalism, the assumption is everybody's interested in accumulating as much wealth as possible, right? So since people are interested in accumulating as much wealth as possible, they need a system which works well. So what system works well? If they give certain amounts of charity, because if they don't give a certain amount of charity, then there are going to be rebellions and massacres and all sorts of other nasty things. So therefore, we don't want to avoid another French Revolution. So therefore, if people should give charity because it provides society with some stability and makes the people, the poor people, happier. And so on and so forth. Yeah?
You're saying that in American society, desire influenced the mind, so to speak. And that's the dominant thing. I remember this one thing that came to my mind. I worked in the telephone switching system, and there were seven new telephones. And we had it, and we had a girl that was dressed very, without dress and so forth. I spoke to the guy, what are they doing? He said, don't tell me how to sell this equipment. I was 20 years old at that time. And I mean, he's correct. He used everything in the concept of desire, a man that he knew what about.
Right. That's, of course, that's the way it works. When you make something desire, the basis of advertising is that really intellect has nothing to do with what you're going to purchase, right? If we can get your emotions worked up over it, so then, you know, that'll be a reason for you actually to buy it, regardless of how good the product actually is.
Isn't that like the pharmaceutical companies when they have, like, the good-looking guys and the, you know, good-looking women?
I think every industry works like that. The automotive industry works like that. The beer industry works like that. They all work like that, and that's the assumption is, you know, you drink beer, you'll get everything you desire, and you know, obviously you saw the stuff for a long time.
Guinness doesn't advertise like that. They advertise that their beer is better than the other beer.
Really?
So all the other beers say, drink our beer and you'll have lots of women. But Guinness actually just says, this is a good beer.
They're really smart. They're really doing it for the right reasons.
All the beers have.
Okay.
If you want to be moral, drink Guinness.
That's right. The effort is beer of choice. So the, but it says, when the mind is the servant of the desire, so people have strategies, they'll devise strategies to do sorts, all sorts of bad things, and they will find rationalizations and justifications for their bad deeds, and they will cover up all the bad things they're doing with a veneer of logic. And so therefore, obviously, somebody has to have first the mind, then the desire. But the woman saw first that the tree was desirable to the eye. And why was it desirable to the eye? So the way he understands it, because by eating the tree, not so much because it's beautiful, that's true, it's beautiful too, but because by eating of the tree, that will make them have more desires. Because somebody who desires wants to have more desire. The famous Gemara says, Mishieshlo Mona Rotse Matayim. Somebody who has $100, he wants $200. You're never so satisfied with what you have. You always want more and more. It's interesting where the Malvin puts it is that not only do you want more and more, but you want more and more. Like the Romans, they say that the Romans, when they had banquets, even when they were full, they used to go out and regurgitate, right, in order to make themselves want more. So there is the wanter wants to want more. That's what the woman saw that is good because she's going to have all sorts of desires. Now, besides that, she says, again, at the final, Lola says after the thought, that it's also good for the mind. But that wasn't good for the mind. In other words, when I won't be able to accomplish my desires because of some thing which stands in my way, then I'll use my mind in order to get my desires. I'll think of ways in order to get what I want. So, as a result, she took from the fruit of the tree and she ate it. Now she takes from the tree and she ate it, she also gave to the to other, right? Now, Adam could have said, and he will say later on, that he also had a loophole. What's his loophole? He was a lamb, Adam Rishon. He knew how to learn. The way the Maharal says, what is loophole? Something like that, he's going to say, I know God who said not to eat, not to take from the tree. But I thought you meant only if I take from the tree myself. I'm not allowed to go and pluck the fruit off the tree. But in this case, I didn't take the fruit off the tree. My wife took the fruit off the tree, right? Blame her. What I did was permissible. Once the fruit was off the tree, why shouldn't I eat it? So therefore, his complaint around is going to say, well, the woman who gave me, she gave me from the tree. It's not mine to do anything wrong. She did it wrong. That's how he passes the buck later on. I tell you a fascinating thing. Which the Mashiach Ishbitzer says. Ishbitzer was a Hasidic Rebbe in the first part of the 19th century. He says, when Adam later says, she gave it to me. The woman you put with me gave it to me, and I ate. So what does he mean, the woman you gave, the woman you put with me, or the woman you gave me? So the Ishbitzer says, what Adam was saying is that, look, you gave me this woman. I assume if you gave me this woman, I'm supposed to listen to what she says. So I listened to her, right? And the truth is, there's precedent for that. Not precedent. There is another case. There's no precedent. But there's another case like that in the Kiddush where Avraham does not want to kick out Yishmael, right? And Sarah tells him, kick out Yishmael. And Hashem says, Kol Asher Tomar Luchot Sarah, Shema Hakola. Everything Sarah tells you to do, including to kick out Yishmael, listen to her. And the Gemara of the Rashi says there that Sarah was a greater prophetess than Avraham was a prophet. So, Lamaisa says he is, but in fact, were Adam Arishon sincere, were Adam sincere what he was saying, that he listened to the woman because God gave him the woman to be his helpmate, to give him advice and direct him, he would have gotten off the hook. But he was lying. He didn't need to treat it, he didn't eat because the woman told him, he ate because he wanted to eat. Now he's just trying to find an excuse. So that's what Hashem says to him, had you really meant it, I would let you go. But you're lying, not besides everything else, you're lying to me now. And therefore, there's no way that you're going to get off the hook for this. Okay, so in the meantime, they both eat. Now, what's not clear, as I told you, what's not clear from this part of, I don't think the Maharal actually expresses it, to explain to you, is what now causes the next part of. What caused the next verse to happen? In the next verse we see, right, their eyes are open. And the eyes of both of them were open. That's on the page, top of page 16 and 17 already. Then the eyes of both of them were open, and they realized that they were naked, and they sewed together fig leaf and made themselves aprons. How were the eyes open? Were the eyes open because they sinned, or because the fruit gave them that quality of perception? It's not clear what they did. Is it the fruit itself? Is what you're going to say? What?
The fruit gave them knowledge. Of knowing what they were actually sinning.
Or maybe the
process of sinning was what
gave it to them. Sinning? Yeah. Because wasn't it the tree of knowledge? Yeah, but I can do that. And once they ate it, they took the knowledge that was in the world. Well, but doesn't it follow from eating the tree of knowledge that they're going to notice that they're naked? Yeah. So that'll make them smart, let's say. It gives them smart. A new focus on good and bad. But what caused them to be ashamed of their nakedness? Was it their newfound knowledge? Or was it the fact that they had sinned? Okay. It's not clear. I always assume that it's in fact the fruit, whatever it was, imparted to them that quality. But it's possible to construct the argument that it was the sin which imparted them quality. Once they messed up, once they're no longer perfect, right, then there's subject to embarrassment. Somebody who's on a perfect, what?
Babies, not ashamed of it. When very young children, not ashamed of it.
Right, it's not when they grow up, they don't become embarrassed because they eat from some fruit, right? It's not because they but rather because that's a function of...
They get a knowledge.
What?
They get a knowledge of what it is.
Yes, where does knowledge come from? Again, the knowledge doesn't necessarily come from the eating of the fruit, but from the experience. You know, experience is important. You know, it's the truth is I'm just playing devil's advocate. I really think it is the fruit itself. But I'm saying it's not 100% clear from the verses. So the knowledge says about this process is, once they ate it, their eyes were open, right? So he says, they bring up for the Rambam, in Marna Buchim, in the Vayikra request, that there's a difference between papak and potak. If the verse could have been written, and were to be written as our school has it translated, it should be vatipasakno enesh mehem, right? In Hebrew, the word to open is ristoach. Ristoach means to open. What here says is the word ristoach. Says vatipasakno with a kuf. See that? What does the word pikeach mean? So the root of this word is potak. Okay? So, okay. The root of this word is pikeach, kufka. There's a difference between those two words. They both need to open. Like we say in the morning, when we get up in the morning, we say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu okay, Melech Olam, Pokeach Ibrim. Pokeach Ibrim means he opens the eyes of the blind, right? So it means open, but it means much more than open. It means to have a revelation. The word Pokeach in and of itself means somebody who's smart. When I call somebody Pokeach, I say that he's a smart person. So doesn't have the implication of open, as the implication of give it imparted wisdom. So I hope that's what the Rambam says here. So he says that the word pikea with a kuf means to remove a covering. Because what does it mean? Their eyes were open the whole time. They saw the tree. I see that open eyes, right? So, and they saw the same thing before that they see now. But beforehand, that which their nakedness was revealed was not considered to be the bad thing, because in their hearts they didn't have desires till now. And they didn't use the procreative organs for anything other than procreating. And by them, it was like the other limbs that a person uses, like his mouth, his nose, and other stuff that he's not embarrassed about, although some people are probably embarrassed by their nose. But the idea of nose didn't embarrass them, right? Now, there became in their hearts these desires. Then they had a new knowledge, that which they didn't know previously. The new knowledge, the pikeach, was that to have nakedness revealed is embarrassing. And that's why it says, and they realized, not that they saw, they realized that they were naked, right? Because they saw they were naked before. They see they're naked now. But now they realize, oh, this is something different. They actually are in a state which is embarrassing. Because nothing happened in their power to see, but their appreciation changed. And he says, one thing, an interesting thing here. It says here, ki erumim hay. You see the Hebrew, the vowels in the Hebrew? It says erumim, with a tsere, under the ayin. The two dots under the ayin, is read as a, right? So really, in Hebrew grammar, strictly speaking, the word should be arumim. Not erumim, but arumim, with a pasach, you know, the straight line under the ayin. So why does it say a room here, or a room, with the tere, with the two dots, instead of a room with the pasach, with a line? So let's see what he says. He says that a room and a room means that it's written here with the tere, means that one's genitals are revealed. Whereas a room, right? Or a rumim, actually it wouldn't be with a pasach, it would be with a kamash. I'm thinking the other thing would be a line under the ayin, would really be the kamash, which should be on the ayin, which would be a rumim. A room is a kamash, he wants to say, it's just you're missing a piece of clothing. Any piece of clothing, if you're missing any piece of clothing, you're called a rumim. But if you specifically have your genitals revealed, then you are an Eruv. Don't ask me why the difference. But he says that that's the difference. And he says that beginning before, it's a very interesting idea. Before, if you look at that, no, I was right the first time. Look back at verse 1. Verse 1, Gimel Aleph, on page 14. There it says, Arumim. Before the sin, man and woman were naked, right? Yeah. And they remained naked. But now they know they're Arumim. What does Arumim mean? Arumim means that their genitals are revealed. I think I understand why that is. Because the word Arumim is related to the word Erfah. Erfah is the word we use in Hebrew for the genitals, the private parts, right? So therefore the word Erfah, which has the three dots like that under the ayin, combined with this somehow, it changes to, in a room, it changes into two dots. I don't know exactly why it changes. But somehow this vestige of the three dots under Erfah, when it means, Erfah means making the private parts, when it comes in, it translates into two dots under the ayin in a room, and a room therefore represents not just missing garments, which is what they thought before, oh look, we're not wearing anything. Whoopsie-doo. Well, now they realize, it's not just we're not wearing anything, right? It's actually that something embarrassing, which should be private and concealed, is being revealed. So
afterwards they wanted to subdue like their animal nature maybe by clothing. themselves, so they became aware that they had an animal nature before. They were just, like we were talking about yesterday, there was a spiritual, the spirituality was a clothing for the body. But now, in fact, you know, they had to go their body because they weren't
as
a spiritual
motor,
it was the physical that was taking, you know, the physical impulsivity of eating.
You told me that yesterday, right? But now I'm not so sure I agree with you. Because animals are not embarrassed about their procreative organs, right? Because animals are really like Adam before the sin. You know, what the, are they appropriate? What are they for, right? There's no embarrassment attached to them. The embarrassment which seems to attach them is the fact that they have a unique awareness which animals don't have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how are you dealing with that? So why do they have to cover it?
Well, because the clothing, like, you know, well, sisters, I mean, the higher form of the clothing, but like the clothing would be, It would be one way that the human being is saying, you know, they're using their frontal lobe, frontal region of the brain by saying, okay, you know, we are different from the animals. The animals, they can walk around naked, mm-hmm. they can have relations anywhere they want, you know, that sort of thing.
So, but from the way you say clothing is an intellectual reaction.
Yeah, it's a moral obligation to subdue their animal nature.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's not when I make it, I say, I'm intellectually aware that I'm naked, so I should cover myself up since I'm embarrassed.
But
they're feeling that they have a moral obligation, though, to close.
I understand what you're saying. I'm not sure. We have to try to understand as we go along next few verses whether it is an intellectual reaction or an emotional reaction. But I think let's see what the Malbim explains.
Before they sinned, when they were naked, they were walking around naked all the time. They didn't realize they were naked. They didn't realize there was anything to be shameful about. You know, it's just another organ. Was the sexual drive the same then? Like, were they just, you know, doing whatever they felt like it, like, you know, all the time? Or was it, like, sort of an act like eating, where, you know, you do it when it's necessary and when you know,
yeah,
you know, it comes up. But, like, it wasn't like it is today. Like,
no, it wasn't a desire to constantly be involved in their activity.
Right.
No, it was just like, you know, whatever was fine, so it was fine. But animals, it's like that too. Animals, their minds are not what? Right. Their minds are not usually preoccupied by procreation.
They're not procreating all the time.
Right. They're only procreating when they're in, you know, in heat at certain times of the year. Most human beings whose mind is on, well, them too, but whose mind might be on procreation all the time. Right. So therefore, there is but beforehand they were like animals. I respect it. When it was time, and that's what they would have done. So he says, initially, their souls, as an interesting thing, this part of the sermon didn't see in the Malvin, but he says he explained above. He says that before the sin, man's soul was less connected to his body. and he was able before the sin to separate his soul from his body, much easier sin, and he didn't need a garment. This is a little bit like you were saying, and therefore he didn't need a garment to cover it, because the body was his cover. It was the soul was primary.
The
body covers the soul.
Oh, well, the body covers the soul, but they were thinking themselves maybe as a soul that had a body as opposed to a body that had a soul.
Right, right, okay. So then before that, their soul was much more separate from their body, and therefore they would see themselves as really being a soul, and jealous, right?
Jealous.
And then they have to have a clothing, which is the body, right? But now, after the sin, their bodies became their souls and bodies became much more attached, much more tightly connected, right? And therefore, they felt, well, the body is no longer my clothing, I am my body. Before, a human being identified with his soul. Remember, we said this a couple of days ago. Before that, a person's eye would be, I want to be holy. Now a person's eye is, I want the ice cream, right? Before, a person's you was, you should eat the ice cream. That was just make a statement. You should eat the ice cream. Now it's, I want to eat the ice cream. Okay, so therefore, that was the difference. Before, a person identified with his soul, his body was his clothing. Now a person identifies with his body, so he needs more clothing for his body. Yeah.
It also makes sense because our souls are constantly yearning to reconnect to Hashem and go back up to Shemayim. So if they were mostly souls, if they just happened to have human clothing, you know, there's a much more elevated state, and our souls were a little more happy. Then, when the soul sins, when they sin, if the soul sins, the sin goes onto your soul. And so it seems like a reasonable punishment for the soul, because the soul wants to get higher up in heaven to punish it, bring it more down, and make it so infused in the body that the body can even forget it has a soul. And then, therefore, you couldn't make it because that's, you feel that this is all I am.
But according to that, the way you're understanding it, it's really, what's your name?
Eretz.
So Eretz before was taking the position that it was the fruit which gave them that state. But from what you're saying, I think it ties in much more to the sin. So it's the fact that now, by sinning, they lowered themselves, right? They lowered themselves, so to speak, into the body. The sin brought them down to earth. So therefore, it would be more the sin, but, you know, let's put it this way. If you eat a fruit, whatever impact it is, it's a physical impact, right? If you do a sin, the impact is a spiritual impact. So if you hold, I'm say there's pure speculation, might be a bunch of baloney, but nevertheless. If you do a sin, so that is the impact on your soul, it brings your soul down, which is what the Malbim seems to be saying. Their soul is more tightly connected to their body. Whereas if you look at the fruit, then I guess the way I would explain it would be more that by eating the fruit, they made their physical selves more dominant, right? They did things to their physical body as opposed to bringing their soul down. I don't know. Maybe it's wrong. I'm not sure I looked at myself.
Before the sin, what does it mean if the soul is more separated from the...
Okay, what happens is that there's actually a state which the early authorities, medieval authorities, called Hispashtus Hagashmius. Hispashtus Hagashmius means when you remove your physical being. And they say when a person bothers, they're not talking about just I have it before the sin, but they say when a person bothers, he should strive and separate himself, so to speak, remove his physical being and become more spiritual. It's a big, this is an opinion among the medieval authorities how you do that. Some say the way to do it is by fasting. Because by fasting, you downgrade your physical body, and you're able to have your soul separate from your body.
And that's the point of downshifting.
Right. But there's the other perspective, which is no. If you're fasting, you're going to focus more on your physical body. So eat and drink, and then you'll forget about your body. You'll be able to uplift your soul afterwards. So it's really, I'm sure different things work for different people. But the idea is, whatever tool works for you, whether it's fasting more or eating more, you're supposed to try and separate yourself from your soul, from your body, and your mind and davening is supposed to be way up there, right? Now, of course, physically you're the same person from the outside, but your soul has become much more separate from your body. And that would happen to a prophet. A prophet, when he prophesizes, right, his mind is somewhere else, so to speak. It's in the higher heavens, right? He's here, bodily, physically, but he's able to divorce his soul from that reality and focus on some much more spiritual reality. Before the sin, Adam had that capacity to a much greater extent, right? He was able to be heavenly, to be together with the angels, so to speak. And now he's not able to be on that level. Now he's diminished. He's primarily bodily. Maybe sometimes he can have the capacity to transcend that, but usually not. So that's an interesting thing about this. Okay, great. Let me just finish this verse and what the Rambam says. The Rambam says, so what do they do? So the first thing there are, he says, in fact, they think, the first thing their artificial intelligence requires them to do. The artificial intelligence, because now, this is not real intelligence, what they got from the tree, right? What they got from the tree is superficial, right? It's something which they gave themselves. That's what he calls it, artificial. It's not God giving intelligence. God didn't want them to have this intelligence. But this intelligence that which they got from eating from the tree was very weak. And therefore, they didn't have more the greater craft to make a garment. They didn't have enough craft to make a garment. All they were able to do is make belts. And not only that, they weren't able to weave. All they could do was make fig leaves, right? They had to take fig leaves and make, but they didn't know about weaving cloth. And he says, later on, the fact that they're going to get leather garments, which God made for them, was divine. So because man was not able at this level, the fascinating thing, man at this level, after eating from this tree, he came down to earth, really. And now he has to know all sorts of crafts, which he did not know beforehand. And now, man, as great as he was, is dumb. Because now he has to start from scratch and do all sorts of things which he didn't know. He didn't have to do. If he would have been on the level of Adam before the sin, he wouldn't have to have clothing. He wouldn't have to have, later on, Rachel's going to talk about weapons, all tools, all those things. So now man is placed in the situation where he actually has to learn all these things. And of course, you start out being a caveman. And be a caveman, all you know how to do is put on your leaves. Okay, stop it.
This model is on the whole.